Welcome to the Apriya podcast series. This episode finds us in conversation with Sanjay Dutt, Managing Director and CEO of Tata Realty and Infrastructure. Journalist Mark Cooper speaks with Sanjay about the beginnings of his real estate journey, moving from an advisory to a principal role, and Sanjay's mentors. Sanjay also shares how Tata has dealt with the impact of the COVID-19 outbreak and what are the ambitions for the group. Sanjay will conclude with his thoughts on the major bright spots for investors in Indian real assets and in what areas Indian real assets industry needs to do better.
This is the Apriya podcast with Mark Cooper, and today I'm talking to Sanjay Dutt, who's MD and CEO of Tata Realty and Infrastructure in India. Good day, Sanjay.
Very good day.
So, as always with these podcast interviews, we'll start with a little bit of personal information. And I've seen that the first part of your real estate career was on the advisory side with CBRE, JLL and Cushman & Wakefield. But then you moved to the principal side, firstly with Capital Land and now with Tata Realty. So how do you have to change your mindset when you've moved from an advisory role to a principal role? And also perhaps you could tell us a little bit about how your experience at those advisory firms helped in shaping you for the current role at Tata Realty.
Thank you. I believe the career and the starting with the consulting firms helped me lay a very strong foundation for the development part of the business. And this was largely because in consulting firms, you get an opportunity to give advisory across the various aspects of a business, from acquisition of land to design, project management, and post-asset development, which is asset management. And then from various other financial aspects, which includes capital market, it gives you a kind of comprehensive approach to business across geographies, which are very diverse in India, and across kind of segments from shopping centers to residential, commercial, and indeed warehousing, logistics, and industrial. And that has been extremely helpful for me. The other question that you asked first was how this transition has been. I believe after a certain stage, I reached a point when I felt that I need to make a difference to a development entity. And the other aspect was perhaps I felt there was nothing more to learn in the consulting space because I'd spent good over 20 years in the consulting space. And when I got the opportunity to work with the Capital Land, active in India since 2007, and the mandate there was to actually grow the business, I felt that I had the necessary experience. So fundamentally, I felt genuinely that I could actually add value to the business of Capital Land. And that was one strong conclusion. And then, of course, the necessary skill and experience and the fact that you're working for a very reputed global organization gave me the confidence to actually take this up. My transition was very smooth. I was able to focus on commercial and industrial, which is what the opportunity at that time provided me. And instead of covering far bigger canvas, which included other segments of real estate, which is what currently I do in Tata Realty and Infrastructure Limited and Tata Housing, the two large entities. So you can say that perhaps the Capital Land was step one and Tata Realty and Infrastructure Limited was step two. So I kind of transitioned in the various stages of development, making it a lot better and easier to transition. I also felt, given the challenges of the real estate sector, there was a need for new thinking. And I felt there is always an opportunity for an upside in the downside. And it's coincidentally, most of my changes in my previous life happened during the disruption of cyclical nature of this business. And therefore, I was somewhat mentally prepared to navigate the business through difficult times as I did in the past. And therefore, that experience of being able to go through some very demanding nature of the sector, market conditions, and the changing landscape in India provided an opportunity for me to bring something new. And I think that single aspect of business helped me in this transition from consulting to development.
And do you have to think differently as a developer? I guess, do you feel more intimately involved with the bricks and mortar when you're responsible for building them?
Absolutely. The responsibility to own the balance sheet and the opportunity while to build, but also be accountable for millions of dollars and billions of valuations of these enterprises puts a huge responsibility on your shoulders. And I genuinely felt that was key aspect between the two businesses.
Okay, great. So yeah, Tata Realty and Infrastructure is obviously a big job. So going down to the sort of nitty gritty a bit, give us an idea about your day as the MD and CEO. What does it look like? And also, maybe firstly, do you have a particular ritual for the first hour or two of how you spend your day? How do you start off each day?
Very interesting question. The day actually starts a quarter before. The nature of the development and the stakes are so high that one has to genuinely prepare significantly in advance. And the reason I mentioned a quarter before, because even though we are not a listed entity, we follow a very strong governance, just like a listed entity does. And we have independent directors on board, and we have to present our five-year strategy, annual business plan, and then, of course, quarter by quarter, very disciplined approach to business. And that basically lays out a lot in advance for me. When it comes to actually starting a day, particularly when you are starting with Monday, a lot is actually required to be done over the weekend to kind of prepare for the next week. And that's what I do as a ritual. In addition to this, there are a lot of aspects of business which requires kind of a disciplined approach to supervise. And therefore, you need to have a very strong engagement with your team and leaders to ensure that that happens. So I give a lot of weightage to personal interaction and communication to ensure that not only your day, but the day for the rest of the organization. And in some of these aspects, you have to reprioritize given the challenges of the market and the business, whether you are really doing that, because that helps mitigate the risk. And therefore, a lot of my time goes in planning, in short.
Okay. And you say you're doing obviously a lot of preparation. So does that mean you're also an early starter, that you're getting things lined up before the official start of the working day?
I am an early starter. I start office around 7:30, 8 in the morning for Indian standards. And it also helps me take a couple of hours, which gives you more privacy in the office to be able to plan and execute things.
Okay. Now, for any business leader, mentorship is really important. Did you have any mentors during your early career who you could tell us about what they taught you or helped to cultivate in you?
Very early in my professional life, I had an entrepreneurial stint. I ran my own business by the name Fast Forward. It was in logistics. And I, between 21 and 25 years of age, went through some early lessons of timing, cash flow management, mentoring, coaching, and anticipating the challenges so that you get up. So that was really one aspect. And subsequently, the inspiration came from one business magazine, which had a headline. And at that read, "People think, I act." And that kind of resonated with me, because I believe as a leader, you can do a lot of strategic thinking, But if you do not roll out tactical implementation plan, you may not get the opportunity to use your insight, knowledge, skills, and experience to test your theory into action. And therefore, that was a huge inspiration for me. Beside this, I was very fond of collecting annual general body meeting speeches of various business leaders. And that was a unique hobby. And what fascinated me was how eloquently the leaders captured the vision, the challenges, the opportunities, very concisely and articulated themselves so they can share with the stakeholders and the shareholders explicitly that what would come next financial year. And I found that as a source of inspiration. The third source for me was somewhat my own small accomplishments over the journey that I had undertaken under extreme difficult circumstances, because real estate was always unorganized in India. Many would say even today it is. And some of that journey covered some extreme situations, especially in consulting, where I was able to make a meaningful difference in a young entrepreneur who now has a listed entity valued over $1 billion and a couple of $1 billion across the country. And I found my consulting space of 20 years provided me that opportunity. And I felt very proud of those. And therefore, those have been my one of the sources of inspiration and self-motivation.
Interesting. Could you tell me of some of the annual general meeting speeches that you were reading? Were there any business leaders in particular that you found particularly inspiring?
I recall one of the speeches given by Mr. Anand Mahindra of Mahindra & Mahindra. Mm-hmm. This was a long time ago, I must say. It was a speech during a NASSCOM summit. And he used a very interesting combination of Hindu mythology applied to business. And it was very unique because we, you know, very often in India, we have Hinduism as one of the, and I'm a Hindu, so quite familiar with Hindu mythology. And I was fascinated by Mr. Mahindra's speech when he created the link between how some of the decisions that we take are basically conveyed in Vedas and Upanishads that we had in ancient India, very early in the civilization. And I found that very unique speech, which I can never forget.
Interesting. Now, actually, on your social media, you occasionally put up the books that you're reading. And I'd just be interested to find out what leads you to choose a particular book. Where do you find the books that you read?
Most of my interest in books centers around business and business excellence and the challenges that the businesses face. And one large aspect which, you know, fascinates me is how different leaders in extreme situations overcome those challenges and establish success. And so most of my choice of books is centered around these themes. And somehow I find that because I'm able to draw parallel and connect with such initiatives and able to apply those in business.
Okay. And what sort of reader are you? Do you kind of pick at things through the day? Do you have set times when you read, or would you kind of keep it for the commute or traveling?
I keep it for the commute and traveling and the weekend, mostly. Most of my day-to-day reading happens in between flights, when you have some time on yourself. And I generally devote that time to news and research papers and reports, which I found fascinating. And then, of course, the books I particularly prefer reading over the weekend, or even if it's during the day, towards later part of the evening.
Okay, great. Maybe we could move on to talk a little bit more about your organization. So tell me a bit about how Tata Realty and Infrastructure has been dealing with the impacts of the COVID-19 outbreak, both in your office operations and also, you know, on the sites in the development themselves as well.
I would like to use this opportunity to convey, first of all, the Tata Group leadership has very abundantly conveyed to all the leaders across various businesses that we need to be respectful to people. And that happens with your own colleagues in the office, vendors, construction workers, customers across. I think the ethos of the group have helped me use all these touch points with a single lens, and therefore make sure that whatever commitments that we have made on all those fronts are honored and stayed. So that's something which has helped. We obviously have also made sure that we adapt to these difficult, challenging times. And I found, again, the culture as a major aspect which has enabled us to control these ups and downs of the last 6 months. And we've been able to overcome the challenges. A big part of this is also financial support and backing, which our principals have actually ensured that we do. And as a result, we have 20 of our projects with nearly 10.5 to 11 million construction restarted across 13 cities in India. And we have over 60% of the workforce in place. So some of these principles, values, and also very importantly, the expectations from each one of these have also put a sense of responsibility on me to ensure that actually happens. So I would draw a lot of, you know, energy and support in saying, recognizing the support that I get from Tata Sons.
Okay. And have you changed the way that you've worked at all to deal with the pandemic? And do you think any of those changes might become permanent after the crisis ends?
Very good question. We have changed, and I believe many of these changes will be permanent. One clearly is digitization and technology acceleration in the real estate space that has already happened, and we've made substantial commitment to see that it happens. The other is remote working, or indeed in using technology to enable remote working and also ensure that dependencies on certain aspects of business is minimized or is mitigated. For example, precast construction technology or the 3D construction, a lot of our business models are now changing. When it comes to internal system and processes, all are completely reoriented on technology platforms. When it comes to customer interaction and vendor interaction, again, technology has started to play a very important role. We made some sweeping changes across board to enable continuity of a business despite the disruption. As you would appreciate, that real estate is a very physical activity. And even though we need to mobilize our managers and project engineers to manage the sites physically, the rest of the business, if it can continue work remotely, whether we are geared up and whether we can give them the tools and platforms to ensure that every employee of the organization is able to manage the business remotely, that was the priority and we've implemented. And we believe some of these refinement of processes, which ensures quick decision-making, is here to stay. So how can we accelerate the process of decision-making without compromising governance and discipline of the business has been one area of our focus during these challenging times. And I think we would like to continue with it.
You mentioned the values of the broader Tata organization and how implementing those is important for the way you've dealt with the COVID-19 outbreak. More broadly speaking, how much interaction is there between your part of the business and the rest of the group?
We are very fortunate that we have the leaders in Tata Sons who have given a lot of weightage on group synergies, group interaction. So we have annual interaction between all CEOs. Then from time to time, we get various opportunities on learning and development, Tata Business Excellence, Innovation Awards, where we get the opportunity to interact with each other. And then subsequently within Tata Group, we have 10 clusters, and Tata Realty and Infrastructure Limited is part of a cluster called Infrastructure, which is headed by Mr. Banmali Agarwal, who's the president of this cluster. And then within the infrastructure, we get almost quarterly opportunity to interact. And that has been a great opportunity of learning because, for example, in infrastructure, we have Tata Consulting Engineering, which does a lot of advisory in real estate projects, I would say globally. Tata Projects Limited, which does the Indian subcontinent in Middle East. So actual construction of the projects as EPC contractors. And then we have companies like Tata Power and TCS. A lot of our commercial activity is to lease spaces to technology companies. So a lot of insight of what the industry trends are as an occupier. We get a lot of that insight from within, and we are able to create future strategies and align ourselves to business disruptors, anticipate the challenges, and therefore also make sure that we identify what our differentiators are in a crowded real estate development space and how we can eventually service our customers better. And I would like to emphasize on this more because the customers' expectations from Tata are very different than the expectations of those customers from any other real estate development entity. And I would like to quote one of the very large American banks. We had an interaction one-on-one with senior management of Tata Sons, and the comment that this gentleman made was that Tata is being viewed as a sovereign in India. And that's a very powerful statement, which meant that if Tata does something or commits something, is viewed as the central bank of a country. And that I thought was a huge compliment. And I think a lot of our partners see that, and therefore these synergies and the status that the group enjoys helps and enables business. But at the same time, it puts a natural responsibility on us to ensure that we preserve those values in the company. So very interesting example. I wanted to make sure that I share this with you.
Very interesting. Thank you. Now, there's a lot of synergies there, but your part of the business on its own is already a big business. So tell me, what are your ambitions for it and for its future growth?
The roadmap for Tata Realty Infrastructure Limited was spelled out in 2018. We wanted to make sure that we are a very balanced real estate development entity. Our business was skewed towards residential, and we wanted to balance that with commercial. Since last 2 years, we've ensured that we have increased our equity infusion and investment and grow the commercial business. One very important statement we made very recently is that we want to scale our business in office market to 45 million square feet in next 7 to 10 years. We already have 20 million square feet of potential, of which 6.2 million is leased and 3 million roughly is under construction. And a lot of build-to-suit negotiations are taking shape, which will have an accelerated development in the commercial space. We are aiming to be amongst top 5 commercial real estate developers in India. On the residential side, we have a very clear vision. We want to make sure that we have an accelerated development in next 5 years and bring our geographic footprint from originally 17 cities, now to 13, and subsequently in next 3 to 4 years to top 5 or 6 cities, and therefore leverage the integrated management that we have rolled out last year between Tata Housing and Tata Realty Infrastructure Limited to optimize this management synergies and have a very balanced portfolio. We believe there would be an opportunity for Tata Realty Infrastructure, whether we do a private REIT or a public REIT, that in 2 years to 3 years' time, we list 15 to 20 million square feet and create, you know, the next line of business.
Oh, fascinating. Yeah, the REIT market in India is something with a huge amount of potential, obviously. Something I wanted to ask about is that you obviously have a big business and big plans, but not everything, not every expansion plan is valid, not everything works kind of right now. Can you tell me a bit about some of the ways you've learned to say no in business, how to kind of to pitch it to colleagues, just to say, maybe we don't have the bandwidth for this right now, maybe in a little time?
Very good question. One of the strategies which went early to the board was that we have too many things going. And from the time we integrated the management of multiple entities into one goal that I had, which is in line with the group chairman goal of simplifying the businesses, was to exit from certain businesses, which was from the long-term and medium-term point of view, was perhaps not strategic. So I took a decision that we will sell our shopping center business, and we sold our shopping centers last financial year. So we exited. The second strategy we rolled out was that it'll be very difficult in a disrupted world and also in excessive inventory space of residential to balance our portfolio with commercial, which is what we rolled out. The third was that we don't want to be in too many geographies and spreading ourselves too thin. So we consolidated and we are on that path of reducing our concentration to fewer cities than 17 cities, for example. In addition to this, it was quite clear that we will actually, there is a natural temptation. Tata is always approached with lots of opportunities in the market. And during these difficult times, we have seen more proposals and some of them very attractive locations, prime locations that have come our way, but we have chosen that we're not going to entertain and look at every opportunity. So while we say that our strategy will be for the six cities, we have actually identified 18 micro markets. So when I say Mumbai, it means Central Mumbai, BKC and Navi Mumbai and Andheri. Very specific locations that we want to grow in, and like that for all of those six cities. What this has done, this has enabled us to apply filters of micro markets, segments which is more commercial now than resi, then within the municipal limits of each city, because we don't want to be in outer peripheral locations, with the exception of one or two which are already part of a portfolio. And so that has allowed us to remain focused and not be, you know, tempted to digress. It doesn't mean that we are not flexible. We would evaluate from time to time, and if we need to revive the strategy, we will do so. But so far, this has helped us over the last 2 years to have a very controlled growth. And I think that is extremely important. The other aspect was that within Tata Group, we have so many group companies who have a lot of land bank. And in the earlier scheme of things, we would actually use every possible opportunity to develop and monetize those through Tata Housing or Tata Realty. Now, with the current landscape, we apply the same filters of cities, locations. And if that portfolio is not part of those strategic decisions that we took 2 years ago, we will not be taking up such development. So that has actually helped discipline ourselves in terms of growth. The other third element is that we are very mindful of the fact that one needs to be very disciplined when it comes to financial aspects of the business. So equity debt ratio, and excessive leverage, which is what has happened in the real estate market, we've ensured that we have put some triggers and checks and balances that we do not deviate from there. I would say these are the few measures that we have taken.
Very interesting. Now, I wanted to move on to talk a bit more about the Indian real estate market. So maybe to following up on what you were saying about refocusing the business to to six cities and sort of 18 micro markets. Could you talk a little bit about some of those cities and those micro markets, which are a bright spot for Indian real estate, and why they're of interest to you as a developer and investor?
I believe the discussion we had so far on the vision to grow our commercial business, the reason we did that because we felt we need to be in cities and micro markets where the demand is. So let's take an example of NCR. In NCR, Gurgaon is the biggest market. And in Gurgaon, Cyber City, Golf Road, National Highway 8, and Golf Road Extension are the growth corridors of the city. And we have chosen to invest in those locations. And two of our projects are near Sector 59 of Gurgaon, which is on Golf Road Extension, and Southern Peripheral Road. We have Intellion Park, Gurgaon, near Sector 59. And we have Intellion Edge, our commercial brand, in Sector 72. So that's a very good example to give you a coverage of Gurgaon. If I was to take an example of Mumbai, we're very clear that we want to be in either CBD or secondary CBD commercial locations. And Navi Mumbai, again, we have invested in 47 acres, 7 million square feet in Intellion Park, Navi Mumbai, which is under development. And by the end of this year, we would be launching nearly 1.5 million square feet of development, although its potential is up to 7 million. And likewise, we have similar micro markets for Bangalore. These three hubs are extremely critical to give you the geography spread. In addition to these three, we have selectively kept Pune, Chennai, Hyderabad, and Calcutta. Calcutta, because we already have projects, but in terms of new investment, perhaps it'll be more restricted to Gurgaon, Mumbai, and Bangalore. That's where 80% of our investment would actually be. And then we selectively would look at Pune, Chennai, Hyderabad, again, those micro markets. So these 18 micro markets, if you look at 47 million square feet of net absorption that happened last year, happened in these micro markets. Since we have such a high economic activity and job creation, it makes sense to therefore complement this commercial strategy with a residential strategy. That's where people want to own apartments and houses. And therefore, we have made sure that we mirror that residential strategy within those demographics so that the businesses are based on economic activity. And so it's not speculative in nature, but more complemented by the demand and the potential of those micro markets. So I would say this is how we have come about with this strategy.
Very interesting. So there's really a lot of focus within the focused strategy. I wanted to talk a bit more about kind of India's overall development as a real estate location. So in your time working with global organizations in India, have you found that that India's status as a market has changed over the years? Tell us a bit about how it's changed.
I often give an example of John Chambers, the chairman of Cisco, and I've been observing him for the last 20 years. Cisco invested in the early part of liberalization and then stayed invested. And I remember the chairman making a statement, I hope it's still there somewhere in the public space. Most of the companies came for cost arbitrage. But over a period of time, they stayed back in India, not just for cost arbitrage, but for expertise and skills. Further, over subsequent years, because of 20 years of legacy of global Fortune 500 and hundreds coming to India and using the services backbone to make the global enterprises stronger, felt that there is a talent to actually monetize for product innovation. So earlier, India would be used for part of the delivery process. Subsequently, we saw GE as an example. GE opened the first R&D center outside of Americas in Bangalore in Whitefield. It was a 50-acre campus called Jack Welch Knowledge Center. It had millions of patents already registered. Likewise, we saw Adobe, DuPont, many other global corporations setting up their R&D centers in India. And I think that was a defining moment when India was reasonably established, not just a country for cost arbitrage, which even today, we still remain competitive, but in product innovation. And then, in addition to this, the strong captive demand of this country. And therefore, a combination of all of this and with the grooming of such a good talent over the years, that India has now naturally been able to produce leaders, which if you were to, without me sounding too arrogant as an Indian, has given many leaders of Indian origin the opportunity to head some great organizations globally. And I think that itself is very, you know, it kind of endorses that all that investment and learning and development that took place in this country has paid huge dividends. And therefore, they have become the ambassadors of India establishing itself as a country, not just for opportunities, but for talent and being able to provide that competitive edge which businesses demand today. And I say that, so even though we have innovation, et cetera, the competitive advantage is still maintained. And that's probably to do with dollar rupee situation as well, not just the talent. So it's a combination which a lot of corporates find extremely attractive.
Interesting. Yes. So it's not just India real estate. It's India PLC that matters and that has grown. So just to round off, after talking about a bit about the positive side, in what areas would you say that Indian real estate needs to do better, either to serve consumers or to attract more capital into the market?
The government of India started the journey in 2005 by opening foreign direct investment in real estate and subsequently has been extremely proactive, particularly this government, to basically ensure that the transparency goes up and the regulations are there to protect the interest of all the stakeholders. So the central government and the policies and the legislations have been extremely transforming in nature, and I think that has helped. However, when it comes to the law of the land on real estate, which is predominantly under the state government jurisdiction, and then I would say taxation, these are two areas where the ease of doing business, the cost of doing business, and the speed of doing business, which in a way is linked to the cost of doing business, if these areas are as transformative as we saw some of the other initiatives by the government, I think India will step up its next stage of growth, which I find now almost inevitable. I think it's going to happen, but it's only a question of time. India is a democratic setup, so it takes time for these things to happen. But the investors that I've interacted with, they are far more confident and appreciative of these changes that they've witnessed. And I think they've also been able to differentiate the partners in the industry, which earlier was not the case. So today, the success and the track record of certain companies and leadership style more than gives a very clear line of sight to every investor, every customer, every vendor, every partner, who to partner with. And I think that has been a big takeaway of the consolidation that is going on in the sector and the reforms and statutory changes that are going on in the sector.
And a lot of the things you're talking about are government related. Are there areas where the people within the Indian real estate business can do better as well?
I believe one thing that Indian developers have to stop is basically herd mentality. It's extremely important that they invest in research, studies, demand supply dynamics, and the businesses need to be disciplined to be able to absorb the setbacks given the cyclical nature of the sector and of course the coincidence of that real estate cycle with the economy and regulatory reforms. That's one big area that we need to ensure. The second, of course, is the reforms in the capital markets, and the sector perhaps needs to enjoy a stronger, credible perception in the eyes of the governments, which so far has improved a bit, but has not reached its goal. These two areas, I think, would eliminate whatever deterrents are there for the real estate sector.
Fascinating. That's absolutely wonderful. Thank you very much, Sanjay. It's been really interesting to talk to you, and thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning into the Apria Leadership Podcast Series. We hope you've enjoyed listening to this podcast. We will be back soon with more episodes featuring industry leaders and dealmakers who specialize in cross-border transactions across Asia-Pacific. If you like what you've heard and would like to give us feedback on future podcast episodes, please contact Sigrid Zialcita at sigrid.zialcita@apria.asia for more information. Please check www.apriaasia or follow us on LinkedIn and Twitter at Apria Asia to get the latest updates.